If it's nerdy, we're into it.
Gaming, movies, television, wrestling, comics, whatever. We are Kyle Eckert and Chris Heck, two lifelong friends with a passion for the world of geekery.
And this is the Geek Ketchup Podcast.
Welcome back, Geek Ketchup family. I'm Chris Heck.
And I'm Kyle Eckert.
And you are listening to Wrestling Recap number 8, where we are breaking down the absolutely stacked AEW event from November 7th, Full Gear 2020. It's an exciting time for All Elite Wrestling, as they recently celebrated the one-year anniversary of Wednesday Night Dynamite, and this was the second annual Full Gear pay-per-view.
With matches ranging from last-minute ads to year-long builds, the event had a lot to deliver on after September's all-out show was arguably the worst in their short history, and storylines like Hangman Page and Kenny Omega's Collision Course have been building for nearly a year. It's also a special moment for us, as this episode marks our one-year anniversary of producing Wrestling Recaps, because we started with Full Gear 2019. Since then, they've become a fun part of our content that allow us to dive into matches and outcomes of AEW and WWE's biggest events.
And like always, we will break down each of the 9 matches, starting with the buy-in pre-show. But before we get started, we want to let you, the Geek Ketchup community, know that we appreciate you choosing to spend your time with us, and we thank you for listening. If you've enjoyed Geek Ketchup, then be sure to hit the subscribe button so you never miss an episode, and leave us a review to let us know how you think we're doing.
You can also find us on social media to get updates on the show and content from the world of geekery. Geek Ketchup Podcast on Facebook and YouTube, at Geek Ketchup Pod on Instagram and Twitter, and links to all of these accounts are available on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. There's also a link to our Patreon page and PayPal if you'd like to support the show. But absolutely, the best thing you can do is simply share Geek Ketchup with your friends and family.
All right, so like we said, first up on the card tonight, we had one match for the buy-in pre-show. And it was kind of a cool match. I know that they did this on Dynamite a few weeks ago, and we saw Thunder Rosa come in, you know, on the last pay-per-view. But they've been continuing that trend of bringing in the NWA Women's World Championship. So we got Serena Deeb versus Allison Kay.
Yeah, unfortunately, I didn't get to see the pre-show match because I had an event to attend on that Saturday night, and I had to record and rewatch on Sunday morning. So it's oddly, well, it's a pre-show match, so not oddly, but it ended up not being on the recorded broadcast on Bleacher Report Live.
Yeah, definitely not a big deal here. I will say that I have really liked how much they've been working in, you know, the other promotions and not being so uptight about acting like there aren't other wrestling companies in the world,
right?
Like we see some other, you know, wrestling companies do in this country. So, you know, seeing the NWA championship coming in, you know, we've seen it with some of the other belts that the wrestlers who are currently holding them, say in Japan and things like that, they've brought them to the show, showed them off, they've been mentioned by the commentators. So that's a super cool aspect, right? It gives us more exposure to the wrestling world. And in this case, with people like Serena Deeb and Allison Kay, not folks that I'm familiar with at all, haven't really had too many opportunities to hear their name or see their skill sets, but now I've seen Serena on Dynamite, saw her here, so it's just a great way to get more exposure to the talent that is out there, maybe if they're not on TV every week.
Yeah, absolutely, and it could be a cool way down the line, like maybe if they get a little bigger, you could do some crossover events. I know that back in the territory days, that was very common to have a crossover event where champion versus champion or undercard versus undercard. But obviously, we haven't seen that since the territory days. So maybe that, you know, opens the door for something like that to happen with AEW and these other companies down the line.
Yeah, that would make a lot of sense and maybe a natural progression as they continue to introduce some of these other wrestlers. So totally all for that. I will say, though, however, that while I thought Serena and Allison were really giving it a lot of effort, they tried to do a lot of technical wrestling. There's a lot of wrist locks, submissions, some different sequences that I, you know, traditionally enjoy. It just wasn't extremely well executed. It seemed like it just kind of had a slow pace, that they were just a little out of sync, you know what I mean? Where They don't have that flow.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it's like ballet and, you know, the wrestlers are just on point and everything's smooth one to another, no matter how complicated it is. And it just wasn't quite there. There's a couple cool moments. I know Serena hit a pretty interesting neck breaker. She had Allison Kay, you know, taken across the middle rope, kind of like the way Vintage Orton, you know, the DDT that Orton does.
Yeah.
Kind of like that, but she gave her the neck breaker onto the apron.
Ooh.
And that looked kind of devastating. So there was a couple of moments, and I can see a lot of potential with Serena, but ultimately not a very memorable match here.
Yeah. A pre-show match for a reason.
Yeah. So we did see Serena ultimately retain the NWA Women's Championship by making Allison Kay tap out with what she calls the Serenity Lock. And that was actually an interesting move, too, where she had one of the arms kind of locked in with her foot, and then she had a Boston Crab on one leg, or so essentially a half Boston Crab, but
okay.
She was attacking the leg and the arm at the same time. Kind of gave me that, like, that STF kind of feel, like one of those.
Yeah.
That was an interesting move, and she got her to tap out, so she did get the win on essentially her AEW pay-per-view debut.
Nice, nice. And retain the championship.
And retain the championship.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah, very cool, very cool.
Yeah, so the only other real thing to note there was that we did see at the very end of this match, Thunder Rosa showed back up and pretty much seemed to be demanding a rematch for the NWA title. So they also used the time to help, I guess, set up NWA's next match. I don't know if that'll happen on AEW TV or if it'll be on an NWA event, but I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I believe NWA does mostly YouTube exclusive content, or they have a subscription of some kind.
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe it could be, you know, preparing for their next big event.
Yeah, I think that would make a lot of sense. But I really expect that we're going to see more of this, you know. It's definitely seems to have becoming more common over these last few months. Like, it wasn't something they did right away with AEW once the Dynamite launched and whatnot. But like I said, I'm all for it.
Yeah, why not?
So with that, that takes us over to the main card. And on paper, it is definitely a much stronger lineup than we saw in the last pay-per-view. I'd say across the board, there were better builds and more drama, you know, for the majority of the matches. We've got Nyla Rose getting her women's championship rematch here with Hikaru Shida. We've got Matt Hardy and Sammy looking for redemption after, you know, what happened with the first match in the last pay-per-view not going quite as planned. And then, of course, we have Cody facing off with Darby Allin for the TNT Championship in a rematch from Fyter Fest a while back when the company was first starting to get going.
Yeah.
So we also, in addition to those, we've got essentially a dream match between the tag champs FTR and the Young Bucks. And honestly, that rivalry has just been out of control and escalating from the moment that FTR showed up. And you know, you can't forget the long history between Eddie Kingston and Jon Moxley, which is culminating here in an I Quit match for the AEW World Heavyweight title.
But it's all about the tag match for me, and we'll get there. But that tag match has been culminating for not just months, but years before they were even in the same wrestling company.
For sure, for sure. There's a lot going on there. And that's kind of a theme through most of the big matches tonight, which is super cool. There's a lot going on, a lot of anticipation for these. But I will say, in my mind, none of them stack up to the year-long build of what I would say has been the best storyline AEW has produced to date. Hangman Adam Page and Kenny Omega have delivered excitement, tension, comedy, conflict, and lots of great wrestling as their paths have intertwined, you know, from winning the tag titles from SCU to Paige's drinking problem. They've just executed a classic storyline that really highlights to me the best of sports entertainment.
It really is. And they were so subtle. You know, it's one of those things where obviously wrestling is a work and or scripted, however you want to call it, say it. But, you know, the subtle hints, so you know eventually these two are going to turn on each other. You know eventually there's going to be a breakdown and then get their match. But they drew this out so long and so well with those subtle hints. You know, they were tag team champs together, and then Paige gets kicked out of the Elite, or maybe he leaves the Elite, the drinking problem, all the little things, and then, you think they're going to break up and they don't, and they come back together. And then eventually they do break up and lose the belts, all that jazz. And it's what you love to see is really long-term storytelling to pays off to fans that are paying attention in the long term.
Totally agreed. And I think that, you know, lately in recent years, we've gotten kind of these 3 or 4 month, like quarter year feuds between wrestlers. And so for me to see such a long build with such an investment and two guys that are, you know, top of their game in the conversation for being some of the best in the world, you know, I really think that they just did everything so well here. And I mean, simply put, it was the match that everybody wanted. And I know, as I just said, it was what I was, you know, looking forward to most on this card. And what's super cool is that it surprised at least me, and it was the match that kicked off the night.
Yeah. Well, it's a solid opener, though. Like, it's just got the hype and the build. You don't want it to get buried somewhere in the middle of the card. So why not just inject life into the pay-per-view right away? And honestly, I thought it was a fantastic opener, because it really did, like, it was such a fast-paced match. And coming off what we said happened in their previous pay-per-view, where it was a bit of a lull, a bit of a dud, they wanted to be like, nope, this one's going to be different. We're going to bounce back. It's going to be better. And what better way to do it with this match and the, you know, the strong build and the fast-paced action?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it really just hit it from the beginning, and I thought that was kind of cool. You know, another little shout out, just because we were talking about other promotions and crossovers, they actually had Don Callis, who I believe is the executive vice president or whatever of Impact Wrestling, who, you know, knows Kenny and them, was there to guest commentate. So it was just one more way to, you know, highlight another brand. It didn't really end up producing too much. I kind of forgot he was there after they announced that, because the match was so intense. I don't even think I can tell you a single thing that JR or Tony Schiavone said, you know, but it was just cool to see another option there that they've done that. But I will say, from the moment that they kicked off the pay-per-view and you first get the glimpse of the 80s aerobic dancers with the sweepers, you know, the sweeper ladies, that was so sweet. I was ready to go, you know, gave me the laugh. Like, I don't know what it is about the broom and how ridiculous it all is, but I'm just all about it when it comes to Kenny Omega.
He's the cleaner, man.
Yeah.
The only knock is JR consistently asking why he's named the cleaner. I feel like he asks that all the time. Like, dude, eventually I want Tony to be like, JR, we've said this to you about 1,000 times. Like, you should remember by now.
Yeah. But they came out, you know, Omega, they're both kind of still baby faces in a way. So Omega tried to take the high road, start the match with the handshake. You know, we got to remember to call out here that, with all the build that came with this match, it actually had a stipulation to it. You know, this was the culmination of the Eliminator tournament that AEW has been running for weeks to determine who the number one contender for the World Heavyweight title is going to be. So, you know, you didn't even need that to make this match so good. And yet you had that thrown in there, that, you know, this big, potentially career-altering accomplishment, you know, was right, opportunity was on the line here. So, you know, Mega came out to give him the handshake. Hey, let's have a good match here. But Hangman was not having it. He pretty much slapped it away, and they just started brawling.
Yeah. Oh, and I thought the entire match, like, especially right out the gate, they hit each other with a ton of chops.
Oh, straight chop off.
Just straight chop off. And it's so funny, because my immediate thought was, I just said how much I love when matches break down and people just start chopping the crap out of each other. And here it is, Kenny Omega and Hangman Page are giving me exactly what I want out the gate in a wrestling match. Just, you know, even keel, like, I know your moves, you know my moves, and just, you know, one-upping each other the whole time. It was just fantastic to see.
Yeah, I liked how they did that, you know, absolutely the familiarity between the two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Kenny started to get off to a strong start after the chop off and looked like he was going to really get on top of Hangman from the get-go. But there were, you know, two or three moments where Hangman had him scouted, knew exactly what was coming, knew that he liked to go for those moves, and was able to hit a pretty effective counter and keep it pretty even paced. And then from there, they just went back and forth. I mean, for being big guys, this match had numerous dives over the top rope into the outside. They were doing, you know, stuff off the top rope, all those counter moves. One of my favorites that really stood out to me was when they were outside and Hangman just kept throwing Kenny into the rail.
Yeah.
And then ultimately he did that backflip.
Omega, when Omega kind of jumped over the small railing and hit the permanent railing.
Yep.
And hit a moonsault.
And hit the moonsault. And he literally was like 4 feet off the ground. I mean, like at most, it was just amazing that he even was able to do that for being, you know, a little bit of a bigger guy. So it was just really intense from the start. I know that they went on to get up onto the entrance ramp a little bit. We're fighting back and forth, and Paige hit Omega with a really devastating pop-up powerbomb, and Kenny just landed like dead weight. I mean, there was no bounce. There was no give. It was just thud.
Yeah.
And then they immediately go into the ring, and he hits him with another big pop-up powerbomb into the pinning combination, but Kenny kicked out. So, you know, pretty much every couple of minutes in this match, there was a huge moment.
Oh, yeah. And credit to both wrestlers. I think the commentary really gave it to Omega's ability to do this, but I think Hangman Page has just as much ability to go 0 to 100.
Oh, yeah.
In it. And at any moment, at any time, he's going to hit something crazy. And I think in this match, he did it with a couple different moonsaults, because there was a second rope moonsault that he hit, obviously the one that was outside the ring. And it's just both of these competitors have that ability to normal fight, and then just boom, out of nowhere, a massive move. And you're like, holy crap. Like, and it almost makes you verbally go, holy shit, like every time.
Right. Yeah, like a guy like Paige, if you think about him, his build, his style, he can be a brawler, kind of Stone Cold-esque in his own way with some of the move sets, you know. But Stone Cold wasn't doing moonsaults and flips out and lariats and things like that, you know what I mean? Like, so
yeah.
He just has such a different, like, more athletic skill set, even though he's got that, you know, 200-something pound build. And it's just always impressive. You know, there's a lot of guys out there that can do that. You know, Omega himself is not a small guy. But, you know, when you get that combination of big power and some of those big guy traditional things we see in wrestling mixed in with a big dive, big moonsault, you know, it just really takes it up a notch.
Yeah.
This one, I could have watched these guys wrestle all night, to be honest. Like, they could have just done 3 hours of this match, and I would have gotten my $50 worth.
Chris wants a triple Iron Man match.
Pretty much, you know, pretty much. But ultimately, you know, they go through what looked like an absolutely exhausting sequence of discus elbows, clotheslines, knees. There was a reverse pile driver in there, and this is all, you know, 20 plus minutes in. And then really after all of that, Paige is pretty much given everything he's got, and Omega gets the win after hitting the one-winged angel and dropping it into the pinning combination.
Yeah, it was a big win for Omega. I'll say, like, I was a little surprised that Omega got the win. I feel like, and that was based on just overall character and popularity. I still feel like Hangman Page hasn't turned everybody into a Hangman Page fan.
Sure.
But Omega has. Like, it's very hard to argue that Omega's not completely over with all fans. Like, he's just so popular. So I was like, in this situation, maybe Page needs more of the win. But they gave it to Omega. And I was originally disappointed, but that immediately turned that around and was like, you know what? Maybe when Page finally gets his due, it's going to be this massive moment, and it's going to be so cool. It almost made me think of like DDP, like in the crowd, like and with the bang and like all the supporters were around him. And I'm thinking maybe that's what I'm going to see out of Paige. Like when his time finally comes, it's going to be epic.
Yeah. Oh, I totally agree. And I mean, I think they could put the belt on him at any moment in time. And with being younger, you kind of assume, okay, a lot of times in wrestling, they are going to put the younger guy over. He's the future. He's the new hot commodity. But it's been interesting that they've used Paige to essentially kind of put over the older guys with, you know, he got the nod with the match with Jericho in the first ever title belt match, you know, way back when.
Yeah.
And things along those lines, right? But in the flip side, that does just continue to build you as a young guy so long as you are consistently performing at the level of these guys, like a like a Jericho, like an Omega, you know, anybody that Paige has been in the ring with, he has pretty much stood toe-to-toe and been able to do it. So I'm with you there. I definitely have no concerns, though, that he's going to get his due.
Yeah.
I will say I really expected Omega to win this simply because I started looking at the big picture. And, you know, Moxley has had the belt for so long that it's kind of getting into that territory, right, of, you know, who's going to be next.
Right.
And just looking at with the tournament that they set up with the, you know, title shot on the line, Mox having the belt and all of that, you know, I was kind of looking at it like Omega kind of started Mox's career in AEW with that first big death match, really launched him. And then, you know, Omega being a top guy in the company has not had a title run yet. So it really would just be super fitting, come full circle by setting up Omega and Moxley again.
Yeah.
Assuming, you know, what happens at the end of the night, right? As long as Mox retains.
Yeah.
That was my prediction, right? Was that's the way we were going to go. And at Revolution, the next pay-per-view, we would see the full circle on Omega and Mox. So.
And that, I guess I wasn't thinking of that in that exact moment in time. But you're right. It really makes it come full circle, especially since that death match with Moxley was exactly a year ago at Full Gear 2019. But Omega, you know, he had the tag belts, but that's not a singles run. And
he said he's not a tag team wrestler, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Like every wrestler on the planet, they probably really enjoy tag team wrestling. But there's only a handful that are going to be content with just being a tag team wrestling champion. Like, everybody wants that singles belt. Why wouldn't you?
Right, yeah, it's one of the top belts in the world right now. So we'll definitely have to see what happens with Adam Page. We will have to see who Kenny Omega is going to be looking to face as we get into the rest of the pay-per-view here, and we'll talk about those matches later. But it was an amazing way to start off the night, and it really set the tone. I was sitting there going, how are we going to follow that? You know,
yeah, it's a tough act to follow, but that's what you want. That's what you want, especially on a bounce back pay-per-view. Come out the gate firing and be like, nope, we're back on track. Let's do this.
For sure. Well, before we move on here, I did want to get your quick thoughts. And I'm talking, give me one liner on a prediction here. There were teasers being released coming into the pay-per-view. And then I had to bring it up because I think they ran two or three promos for this during the pay-per-view, but apparently, and we're recording this is Sunday after Full Gear was on the 7th, so this is Sunday the 8th, and by the time this comes out, this announcement probably will have been made, but I want a prediction out of you. AEW Video Games was promoting some big announcement coming this Tuesday night. There's speculation that it might just be that more wrestlers are going to start, you know, Twitch streams and things like that, because that seems to be so popular.
Right.
But the other speculation is that they're going to announce an AEW video game. So, Kyle, in just one sentence, what is your prediction?
I think it's going to be a YouTube channel.
Okay.
Very similar to what Xavier Woods does on the other company's side. That is my prediction, that it's going to just simply be a YouTube channel with more streamers, Twitch streamers, and those guys getting into that game. I think it comes hot off the heels of that other company kind of banning their people from doing Twitch streaming. So they're seeing an opening in the market, and they're being totally different at all costs.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it's going to be.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens. I think it's a little too early for a video game, but, you know, Omega and a lot of those guys are huge gamers, so
yeah.
Who knows what could be going on in the background. Just had to throw that in there. I think we'd always geek out if we hear that that there is an actual video game coming, though. You know?
That would be amazing. Obviously, if it was a video game announcement, I'd be super jazzed up about it, but I'm next tempering gen. Expectations. Yeah, next gen, the works. But I'm going to temper my expectations and say that it's just going to be a new brand, a new YouTube channel led by Kenny Omega.
All right.
And just tap into that market.
All right, we shall see. Keeping it going here, though. The next up, I will say this match felt a little odd on this card because everything else had so much, you know, importance and build to it. But Orange Cassidy is absolute lightning in a bottle right now. He's one of the hottest guys in the wrestling world. And so we got a matchup of Orange Cassidy versus John Silver. I guess just because I don't know if Cassidy even understood why he was there, but it was probably the least exciting match just looking on paper, even though Orange Cassidy is usually always pretty entertaining, and I'm generally okay with him showing up on any show.
Yeah, OC is absolutely amazing, but I think this match happened because John Silver is part of the Dark Order.
Yeah.
And OC's been feuding with the Dark Order a lot lately.
Sure.
So like, maybe, you know, not much of a build, but some of a build. Why not? Who gives a crap? OC is amazing, and he's cornered this market in wrestling that I didn't even know that I would love as much as I do. And it's this, like, skilled wrestler in ring while also being a hilarious comedy act.
I can see that. Yep. Yep.
Because you normally don't get both. Like, either you're a joke and you're there for laughs, or you're really good technically.
That's true.
And he's been both. And he's just, Orange Cassidy is freshly squeezed, man.
Yeah. No, he does a good job. He's definitely an entertainer. And he's always doing something a little bit different, right? So, yeah, I like the moment here where John Silver got really mad at Orange Cassidy for putting his hands in his pockets, and he literally ripped the pockets off of his off of his pants so he couldn't do it anymore. You know, that was a new way to approach it. I thought Silver showed off some good power for his size, but to be honest, to me, he's a really uninteresting guy. He just comes off as a huge case of Napoleon Complex because he's a smaller guy, but he's kind of jacked. And honestly, I don't know what you thought about all the posing in ring. But it really, like, all I could think about was the masterpiece Chris Masters from the mid-2000s, you know? Like, because he sucked in-ring for the most part. He had, like, three moves, but he would just, like, go full Arnold, you know, like, bodybuilder posing the whole time because he was
just
jacked.
Chiseled, yeah.
Right, but, like, Silver isn't even as jacked as a guy like Chris Masters, so I don't know. It really just kind of rubbed me the wrong way, you know what I mean? Like, I felt like I was just watching Orange Cassidy at this point, you know? So, it wasn't a bad match. It was well executed for the most part, had some big moves. It really just, with how stacked the card was, I felt like it just felt a little unneeded. You know, we could have taken that time and given it to some of these other matches that were a little bigger. You know, in the end, OC won pretty much as expected. He hit a combo of the Orange Punch and the Beach Break, and then pin Silver 1-2-3.
See, I'm actually going to disagree with you a little bit here, because I was really impressed by John Silver.
Okay, you
know,
okay.
Yeah, I thought he had several, like, you know, he lost. And I kind of thought, like, yeah, I would agree with you in a sense where there's not too much to say about the match overall. But I think it was solid start to finish. There was no, like, down times. It had funny moments between the hands in the pockets or when he was doing his little leg kicks. John Silver was like, this doesn't hurt. Why are you doing this? This doesn't hurt.
It was definitely entertaining, yeah.
And then he went on to do a couple power spots. I thought his power spots were very impressive. He had the one where he had Orange Cassidy in like a fireman's carry and then threw him kind of F5 style, but he didn't fall with him. He just kind of chucked him.
Yeah.
And Orange Cassidy helicoptered and then landed. I thought that was pretty cool. And overall, while he did lose, I thought the match gave him a bit of credibility. Like, he still impressed me. And I'm thinking, you know, to go back one match, that's kind of what Paige did. Like, Paige was still very impressive in his loss.
Yeah.
And that's how I felt about this match with John Silver, where up until this point, the Dark Order is just a bunch of, you know, nameless, faceless beings.
Sure.
And he's finally found a way to stand out. You know, his triceps are ridiculous. There's no way that man wears a normal size shirt. And he kind of looks like a little bit of like a Lord of the Rings dwarf in a way with the beard
that.
And the hair.
Yeah.
But, you know, and obviously you're just like, Kyle, you're just pointing out all these things about his looks. But I thought, you know, he made a solid first showing.
Sure.
Like a solid first impression that, like, he's clearly got a long way to go. He's going to develop a little bit. But I was impressed nonetheless.
Yeah, maybe for me it's just because the Dark Order factor. There's a lot of people in that group, and none of them really have stood out, you know, much, especially with Brody Lee. You know, so it's just one of those things of, it's just a Dark Order guy. You know what I mean? So it was just naturally uninteresting to me from the get-go. But that's fair. We'll have to see, you know, does he go back into the shadows? Does he, you know, pop out a little more? Seemed like the kind of guy that would fit perfectly if they had some sort of like cruiserweight level belt, yeah. you know, with his size and everything. But for now, I think, you know, OC will move on to another opponent and John Silver will probably just fade back into the Dark Order, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And I guess ultimately that we'll see what happens. You know, if they can find something and find a spot for him to work into, that would be great. But you're most likely, you're right, he's just going to fade.
Yeah.
I will say, just to your other point, I think I actually would have preferred to have seen a women's match here, an undercard women's match.
Right, exactly. Like, it needs more support than OC does.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Like, this could have been a main event on Dynamite.
Right.
Or, right. I mean, I guess not necessarily AW Dark, because not everybody watches AW Dark, but this could have...
Dynamite for sure.
Yeah, Dynamite. Yeah, why yeah. couldn't have this been a main event on Dynamite and give them that platform and then give the women the pay-per-view platform?
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. You know, it's just an issue that they have, though, I think, right now with AEW, so... That's another topic for another day with how they've handled the women's division and what their issues are there. But anyways, next up, we're keeping moving here before we go down too much of a tangent. We had one of the longer builds, you know, leading into this card with the TNT Championship on the line. It was Cody versus Darby Allin, you know, trying to become the, quote, face of TNT. And I don't know if you've seen a lot of the promos and vignettes that they've been doing leading up to this, but really dark stuff, really interesting, provocative stuff from Darby Allin, like he's always doing. Of course, you usually are getting pretty much A-plus level promos out of Cody, but they put a lot of effort into this rivalry building, even though, you know, Cody and Darby hadn't fought in a few weeks, but they really were building on the history, building on Darby kind of being this underdog, Cody being, you know, the top rich guy, preferred family in the company, all of that, you know, executive of the company.
The executive, yeah.
You know, so that was pretty cool. They really set a great tone, you know, from the moment that Darby rolled in, because he came in on that busted car.
Yeah.
Smashes the windshield with the skateboard, pretty much showing that he is all business. We saw on the flip side, then Cody shows up. He's got the full Nightmare family, he's got the gun club, you know, the full entourage, so it kind of stacked up like Darby Allin versus an army.
Yeah, absolutely. And then once they get in the ring, the size difference between the two.
Like, oh, yeah.
It's wild because, well, Cody, you're not going to sit here and say Cody's not a big dude, because he's obviously 6'2", 6'3", probably in like the 230 range, so he's bringing some weight, yeah. But he made... Like I guess where I kept getting confused, I was like, is Darby Allin making Cody look massive, or is Cody making Darby look tiny?
But a little of both, maybe.
A little of both. But like, they perfectly set that up, that underdog, like massive entourage, massive dude going against a lone wolf.
Yep.
Like doing his own thing, the Enigma.
Yeah. Well, and he had Darby, you know, he was covered pretty much like head to waist in that signature skeleton paint that he always does in some different ways, you know, and then he's got his, you know, tore off jean shorts and all of that, you know, very goth, low class in a way, you know, type gear.
Yeah.
Like, he just got it out of Goodwill and made it to come to the ring. Essentially, he's doing it on his own.
Yeah.
And then he had Cody, who always has great ring gear, but I thought that he almost went like an extra mile here. Maybe to kind of play into some of these tones, you know, behind the scenes or whatnot. But he had, I mean, it just looked super brand new, super high class, super expensive, you know, black and like kind of like Carolina Panthers blue and silver gems and stuff on there. Like, it looked like he just spent $5,000 on some Gucci wrestling pants. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, yeah, they were blinging. Yeah. That's for sure. Like, yeah, I think he had he always has the little leg strap, and then it's a knock on Cody's gear in general, but I hate like the cup,
like, oh, how yeah.
his, you know, how his ring pants always seem to accentuate like his groin and like, yeah. like he's wearing a, like an athletic cup.
Yeah.
But all of that was bedazzled, like the cup and the yeah. leg strap were like bedazzled to the max. So it definitely should. That's subtle. I didn't think about it until you said it, but you're right. That's a nice subtle play over, you know, I am the executive. I'm the one that wears the suits. I sit in the board meetings.
Right.
And, you know, who are you? You know, you're hanging out with Steve-O. And
right.
that's it.
Yeah, so I mean, it's just kind of the little details, I think, that sometimes can add to stuff. But when they got into it, you know, I think most of it felt more like an old school kind of heavyweight pacing. Yeah. But they did have some moments where it picked up and really kind of made you pay attention. There was some high-risk maneuvers off the top rope and things like that. But, you know, it seemed to be more of a Cody's match. He was in control for the most part, his pacing. And that surprised me a little bit with how Darby is, but I think it worked out.
No, it was a little slower pace from the first two matches, which makes sense, I guess, if you're trying to balance the overall show. But it was a little too slow for my tastes. And in fact, it's the reason that when I got home last night and I had an opportunity to watch the pay-per-view, I turned it on and this was the match that was on.
It was just
moving a little too slow. And like I said, like we had gone and like we went to this event and we were doing this thing. And so you get home and you're like a little tired and, you know, you're out and, you know, you're socializing and doing that whole thing. And you're, you know, like I said, like it's COVID time. And so, you know, you go and you do something, you feel a little just off because you're like, you know, I did kind of just put myself at a little bit of a risk. So like I came home and this was the match that was on. I was like, okay, well, I still got some time to watch this pay-per-view. Actually, I can just pick up and I can watch the matches I missed in the morning. And this match was so slow that it actually caused me to be like, you know what? I'm too tired.
Yeah, and like go to sleep if you watch.
Yeah, I was like, the original plan was to watch in the morning, and that's what I'm going to do. And it was because of that slower old school pace.
And I thought that they did a pretty clean job. They had a couple cool moments here, like Cody hit Darby with this crazy shoulder breaker off the top rope that I thought looked pretty hardcore. Darby ultimately, you know, tore one of the turnbuckle pads off and, you know, forced Cody into it chest first. Maybe the highlight of the entire match for me was what I thought looked insanely dangerous, which was the avalanche crossroads that Cody dropped on Darby off the top rope. Like, it made me tense up when they executed it, but I really think that was the first time I've seen a crossroads off the top rope, like with that spin from the side and everything.
Yeah, I can't say that I've ever seen it in it that. That move, just standing, looks a little like twisting, and you're like, oh man, one little arm or neck gets caught or hooks when you're trying to make that rotation, and it you could really maybe not break a neck, but sprain a muscle in your neck, sprain a muscle in your back, and to see it viciously dropped from the third turnbuckle was a little intense.
Yeah, that was definitely my favorite move of the night. After that, you know, Darby still managed to kick out. The match kept going. You would think that, you know, a crossroads off the top rope, my first thought was it's over after that. It was such a big spot. But Darby kicks out. You know, he just will not give up. He got a surprise pin after hitting a Last Supper, but Cody kicked out of that. And then Darby went right into pretty much a textbook coffin drop. Cody kicked out a second time. And that for me, I don't know about you, but that for me, I was like, okay, Cody is going to win this. Like, you know, that looked like that was Darby giving everything he could. You know, he's already been hit with these devastating moves. So I thought that was going to end up being the end for Darby.
I wasn't totally convinced because I felt like Cody had, it's sometimes you're reading the room and I was like, Cody's had the belt for a while.
Sure. He does,
you know, he just got his name back. It opens up the door for other things that he could go do. He doesn't necessarily need the TNT belt anymore. Let's put it on somebody that could really like show it off on TV. So I was convinced Darby was going to win the whole time, no matter what happened.
Well, and you would have been right because, you know, Darby definitely surprised me. He managed, they went through one of those sequences where it's just, you know, four or five back and forth pins. They were making Mike Chioda work, you know, honorable mention to the great Mike Chioda for sticking on top of that. But, you know, kind of like how Cody had beat Darby in their last match with kind of a surprise roll up, you know, just enough to get the pin.
Yeah.
Darby ended up getting the roll up on Cody and got the 1-2-3 and is the new TNT champion.
Yeah, the face of TNT. And they are really driving that home, as I saw on just about every Twitter handle this morning, that they are driving it home. He is the face of TNT.
Yeah, I mean, he's gotten a lot of good response from the fans. I think that there's a lot to like of Darby Allin. You know, it we'll have to see how long he holds it, right? You know, how long he can overcome some of these really big guys, really big names that, you know, AEW has in the mid card. And, you know, it kind of proves that just because, you know, as soon as this match was over, Cody, you know, did the great thing, presented the belt to him. The fans were chanting, "You deserve it. You deserve it." It was a great moment for a wrestler. And really, you know, with his background and all he's been through, getting to that point, you know, was obviously a huge moment, probably for him professionally and personally. I think we're going to get some good matches out of him as champion. But to wrap up this whole situation, Taz then came out, interrupts the celebration, and sicks Brian Cage and Ricky Starks on him, you know, pretty much saying that they want the TNT championship. So, you know, they destroyed him after the match. And, you know, it's kind of hard to see, can Darby Allin stand up to Brian Cage? You know,
I think
he could with Ricky Starks, but if this ultimately goes through Brian Cage, I think that might be the end of the road for him. So we'll have to see. The whole Brian Cage thing is interesting in itself with Taz, but did you have any thoughts there before we move on?
No, I'm right there with you. He's the type of guy and the type of character that is going to win 1 out of 10, maybe 3 out of 10, but at the end of the day, the bigger competitor is going to typically win that fight. And so how many times are they going to play the "he did just enough to survive" trope on us? And I think it can only go so long and so far. The interesting thing, if they do go down the path of Taz and his crew, is that Ricky and Brian, when they both were holding the belt, neither one of them wanted to let go of it.
Right. Looked like it created some tension right away. That's for sure.
So, like, that could play into the story, which would be cool. But if it's just a straight up one-on-one, looking at the behemoth that is Brian Cage, how do you justify that in a sport that also does a lot of basis in realism?
True. Yeah, we'll have to see. I know that there was a lot of fans, that there was a lot of rumors that Sting was going to show up here and be in Darby Allin's corner. Apparently, WWE has dropped all the Sting merchandise and stuff because the contract, I guess, with them is up. And so most people were expecting, given the how Darby was hanging out in the rafters and some of the things that were very, you know, Sting-like in the NWO days, there were some thoughts there. That did not happen, which I was a little bummed out about. I thought that would have been cool. You know, I think Sting as a manager or something like that could actually really work right now, given you know, where he is and the darker side of Darby Allin. But maybe as we were talking, it just came to mind is maybe they're going to slow play that. You know, maybe Darby does go up against Taz and Brian Cage and, you know, barely gets through or is against all the odds. And then Sting shows up to, you know, help him out or something along those lines. We'll have to see, but some interesting stuff there.
Yeah, we'll have to see how that works out. I can't say that I'd be too thrilled about him coming in and just playing full manager. I think AEW has enough managers right now.
They do have a lot of managers.
Yeah, which is awesome, because that's something that I feel like we've kind of been missing in wrestling for a long time, is the solid mouthpiece. But almost like everybody's got a manager, and like everybody's got something on their side, whether it's like Tully Blanchard or Arn Anderson, Jake the Snake Roberts, like Vicky Guerrero, like
that is true.
Managers everywhere. So I think I'd rather just see him come in and guest spot and not be a permanent fixture.
I can be okay with that. It's funny. And you bring her up, so it kind of transitions us into the next match here, because, you know, a manager was involved and her name is Vicky Guerrero. But it's funny, like I had it here to see what you thought about the return of Vicky G as we were getting into this match. But really, you know, I had the same thoughts. Like, I really am digging that AEW has brought managers back in a more traditional and like important role to wrestling. I think that they've always been so important and a fun part of wrestling. But at the same time, it's just like, boom, everybody has got a manager. And it's kind of the same thing they did with the stables. You know, when they started AEW, it was kind of refreshing that they were really bringing back stables and there was all these groups. But then, like, you know, 6 weeks into Dynamite, it was like every single person was part of a stable, you know?
Yeah.
And it kind of stopped, I felt, in some ways, or maybe culminated when they tried to create Death Triangle, you know, just to put the Lucha Brothers with Pac together, because they were like, oh, we don't have a stable, you know, what are we going to do here? But so maybe they need to figure out a better balance on some of that kind of stuff. Yeah. But they are bringing them back. Vicky Guerrero's back. She's with Nyla Rose, and Nyla Rose was back to get a rematch against Hikaru Shida for the AEW Women's title. That's a lot to say. Kyle, what are your thoughts?
I was blown away to see that Shida is the longest reigning women's champion in AEW ever at 168 days at the time of the pay-per-view. That number jumped up way faster than I ever expected. You know, and thinking back, yeah, she won the belt two pay-per-views ago, and
yeah.
AEW does a quarterly pay-per-view schedule versus the monthly. So it wasn't like, oh, wow, like it's not a Goldberg number that just like suddenly sure. is in the hundreds and makes no sense. But I was like, dang, she has been champion for a while. It was pretty cool. She's held it long and held it well, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, well, I mean, I actually thought that the first match when Shida took the belt from Nyla, I actually think that was the best women's match that AEW's had so far in their history. So while this match had almost no build to it, I think they really put it together last minute on the previous Dynamite when Nyla Rose showed back up.
Yeah.
But I was super pumped for it just because I was like, okay, I love women's wrestling. I like both of these women wrestlers, and they have literally what I think is the best match that the women's division's had.
Yeah.
So let's get more of that. And ultimately, I thought they actually did really good. It might not have been quite as good as the first match, but it was right up there. And we saw some storylines develop that we haven't seen with Nyla Rose. I mean, pretty much from moment one in this match, Shida kicked the shit out of Nyla Rose.
Oh, yeah.
And we have not seen Nyla be dominated and manhandled by anybody, let alone somebody who is seemingly as tiny as Hikaru Shida is.
Yeah. No, I loved the fast pace that this match brought, because, like I said, the Cody Darby match dipped a little bit in its pacing, so like there was a bit of a lull. You know, and like I said, it's all overall balance on a card, but they came out the gate like boom, firing. I was like, all right, whatever lull was there from the last match is gone, and we're back to the high pace, the high action. And you're right, they kicked the crap out of each other.
Yep.
Almost to the point where I was like, this match is more aggressive than the original match, which was no holds bar.
Right. In some ways it was, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Shida was throwing kicks and punches left and right. Nyla definitely had some moments, and they had the whole issue with Shida, you know, hurting her knee, and Nyla was using the ring to, you know, extend it and exploit it. Shida actually sold her knee injury really well all match, I thought. I mean, like, she was, like, always aware that her knee was busted, and yet she was still overcoming. She even had a couple kind of powerful moves on the much bigger Nyla, you know, back body drop and I think a big suplex and stuff, you know, stuff that you don't typically see when there's that big of a weight difference or size difference, I guess, between any two wrestlers, men or women. She even actually towards the end of this match hit a freaking Falcon arrow off the top rope on a Nyla Rose.
Yeah. Yeah, it was wild. Like, she definitely got some lifts. And I remember thinking or saying when Nyla Rose fought Chris Starlander, it was like you needed somebody that could actually power move Nyla Rose a little bit.
Yeah.
And somehow, some way, Shida, who's smaller than Statlander, it got more power moves on her. It was amazing. And I wrote it down. I was like, honestly, I think Hikaru Shida gets the best out of Nyla Rose, which is awesome, because I was starting to question, is Nyla Rose going to make it? Like, she's this dominant force, this dominant personality. She comes to the ring with this massive presence.
Yep.
But she wasn't putting on these matches. And then here comes Shida and gives her two just knockout matches, which really reinvigorates my belief that, okay, she is going to stick around in this industry for a while.
Yeah, I would agree. They definitely have chemistry. They know how to play those size differences to their advantages. Nyla is very imposing, and I think that she has been, you know, one of the better wrestlers that they have. But I thought that Shida kind of came into her own in a lot of ways. You know, she doesn't cut a lot of promos. She's definitely been kind of doing her talking in the ring when she's got matches. But I will say, like, I kind of stood up and paid attention when she dropped that Falcon Arrow on Nyla and then went to pin her and then pulled Nyla's move and pulled her up. Had that evil-ass look on her face. Like it almost just struck me as, like, okay, here's almost, maybe it's not a face-to-a-heel situation, but, like, here's a defining moment in a wrestler's career, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
If she takes that intensity and can build on it somehow, like, that wasn't something we've seen out of her in her matches. Like, it was almost like the biggest pop of personality that we've seen in her wrestling from that standpoint, or storytelling in a way. So I really, really liked it. We'll have to also see how it changes Nyla Rose, because, you know, now we know that she can be dominated. You know, she kind of came down a peg, essentially, in the fact that she can be beaten like that. So
yeah,
we will have to see. But she ultimately did retain the belt after hitting Nyla with 3 repeated knee strikes right to the face. After everything that happened, she just kind of came up and was like, doosh, doosh, you know, just kneed her right just in the face.
Like
3
multiple
times.
Muay Thai knees, just pow, like almost like a knockout blow.
Exactly. And then just collapsed on her and got the pin. Girl Hepner got the 1, 2, 3, 4. So I thought that was pretty cool. You had some storytelling going on because Vicky Guerrero was losing her shit on Nyla Rose for embarrassing her. Even slapped her.
Oh, and it was a big slap. That looked like it hurt.
Yeah. And I think kind of with the Nyla piece, that's also part of the reason why I said it's interesting to see the story kind of change or whatnot, the character development, because I expected her then to just kill Vicky Guerrero.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I thought she was just about to straight up pop up powerbomb her ass through the ring, and then she kind of just sulked and went with it. So they're doing something there.
Yeah, absolutely. They had subtle, you know, like you said, it's not a full blown like character turn on either end, but it is laying the groundwork for something we may see in the future, which, like we said, that is something AEW has done well and we very much appreciate.
All right, well, we've got a couple matches left here. I know the next one is definitely one of the top ones a lot of people were excited about. I know Kyle was super excited about this one.
Yeah.
And I can't lie, I was absolutely excited for this one, too. Everybody knew this was going to be a barn burner. The builds, the promises from FTR about this being one of the best tag matches of all time. You know, the Young Bucks are very often in the conversation for having matches that could be the best of all time. So this was FTR versus the Young Bucks for the tag team championships. And there was a extra stipulation here that kind of like Cody back in the day when he fought Mox for the, or Jericho, I think it was, for the AEW title, you know, where if he lost, he could never compete for that title again. The Young Bucks had that stipulation here. If they lose, they can't compete for the AEW tag titles ever again. And they came out ready to go. We had solid Lakers attire for the Young Bucks matching up against some classic retro Celtics attire for the FTR. You know, there's white and green jumpsuits. So that was pretty cool just to kind of get things going. But as we said earlier, tons of build into this rivalry pre-company. Once FTR came in, ever since they got the belts, it's just been escalating and escalating. So I'm going to let you take it here, Kyle. What did you think about this match?
Oh, I honestly, tag match of the year. 100%.
Ooh,
tag match of the year.
Okay.
This tag match had everything that I want in a tag match. Like, just, there was solid corner work, like fantastic tag team moves from the classic cutting off of the ring where you don't let the partner get past halfway and you keep dragging them back, keep them in your corner, pound it, ground and pounding them. You're constantly doing the quick tags in and out to keep the fresh member in the ring. Then eventually you get a solid hot tag. That happened on both sides of this match. Like,
that's
FTR
true.
Got that. The Young Bucks got that. There was amazing storytelling and like legitimate amazing storytelling long-term from Matt Jackson's ankle coming into the match, like FTR a couple weeks ago, you know, they put his ankle in the chair and then it was like a high ankle sprain. So what, he wasn't 100%, but it wasn't going to stop him. They immediately went to the ankle as being a focal point of the story.
Yep.
And then they kept it. That didn't go away. That ankle played a part through the entire match. And the match ended up being like 35 minutes.
Yeah, it was long.
Like, that was incredible. And another long-term, like, in-match story is when Dax Hardwood cut his hand.
Right.
And then later in the match, he goes to throw a punch, and he hurts himself by throwing a punch with his hurt hand.
Yeah.
So like, all of these factors, two amazing tag teams, like, and the difference in styles, you know, you've got the Young Bucks, a little more high flyer, a little more high action. Obviously, FTR is your ground and pound. Before all this, they had the no flips, just fists, and they showed that, and then, you know, I'm not going to spoil the ending, but that played a huge part into how the match kind of progressed, because on several occasions, Cash Wheeler went outside of his comfort zone and yep. went for that high flying, and it never paid off. It cost him every single time he did it. So, and I was like, this is just blowing my mind with every single little piece of this match is coming together to, in my mind, make match of the year. Tag team match of the year.
Yeah, I think they lived up to it too. There wasn't a single down moment in this match. You got me laughing over here because I really couldn't help but just continuously laugh at Cash as he was like, because there were times where he just like wasn't on camera and then he just come flying through and he would like go through the ropes or like when he hit that table like off the apron, off to the corner. I don't know. It was just like left and right. He was just flying around and then he'd be gone for a few minutes, like recovering from his ridiculousness. But yeah, I mean, they had everything you want here. I especially noted how well they handled, you know, cutting the ring in half, keeping Matt in the ring, continuing to, you know, pound him, the quick tags. They are really, really good at it. And it's a style we just don't see as much in the modern age, which so I think that's one reason why it just stands off is because it's tried and true, and when done at a high level, it's extremely entertaining. We just don't see it a lot out of the tag teams of the modern, you know, wrestling era. But I did think that one of the coolest things that they did here was that not only did they showcase their own skills and their own moves, but there were at least four or five moments where they paid tribute to yep. other great tag teams by doing their moves. You know, there was the DIY moment with the taunts, the Swanton Bomb, you know, yeah. Hardy Boys moves. I don't even know if I caught them all. It's just they were talking about them on commentary. It was just one moment after another. So it was just too much cool shit going on to fully remember everything.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure at some point there was a double drop kick.
Yeah, double drop kick, double sharpshooters.
Yeah, like, and that's what I mean. Like, it was every single nook and cranny of a tag match was involved between the classic tag moments, the great tandem offense, and, you know, storytelling done well. It really was. There's nothing. It had everything that you want in not just a tag team wrestling match, but a wrestling match where. Yeah. It has ebbs and flows where they sped it up, they slowed it down, they played story moments, you know, they had some outside, got to the outside, did some moves, flew through the ring ropes and onto like out into the apron, outside,
yeah.
you know, dive in saves, power moves, big kickouts. It was just phenomenal.
Dude, when Cash powerbombed Nick onto the table outside and then came back in for a spike pile driver. And then they had that pin, and Matt just barely got his foot onto the rope. Like, yeah. the injured ankle was what he got onto the rope to save him from, you know, losing the match. It was just moment after moment. There were so many close pins. The moment where Dax had an inverted figure four kind of ankle lock submission on, and it was broken up when Nick came in and went Too Cold Scorpio and dropped a 450 splash on him. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. that was just insane. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
It was so good.
Good. Yeah, it was so good. It was tag team wrestling at its best. Like you said, it's a bit of a lost art, you know, like we said earlier, where not everybody in a tag team wants to be in a tag team. They want to move on and be that single star. But what we see here is two tag teams that want to be the best tag team in the world. It was written across FTR's ass. Greatest tag team of all time.
Yeah, you know, GTTOAT.
It's like, it's what they want to be, and it's what they excel at. And it's just, it's very refreshing to see it. And, you know, they're where they want to be. They're doing what they want to do. And they're putting on amazing performances. Like,
yeah,
just, you can't say much more.
Yeah. I think a lot of people give AEW in general, but also AEW tag teams, a lot of slack online. You know, we see it regularly about how much it is, you know, with just the flips and the high flying and the spots and you know, they try to tear them down. Personally, I don't find that to be such a bad thing because it's just sheer athleticism. It's entertaining. But I think this match really showed that they are more than capable of doing, you know, advanced storytelling all along the way. I mean, this match literally had storytelling from moment one to the very end. And really, you know, it was highlighted because after, you know, 30 plus minutes, both teams giving everything they have to win and nothing getting them over that hump, you know, they essentially, you got Dax, I think, was knocked out onto the apron. And so Cash goes looking for him to get the tag, but he's not there. So he's kind of looking around. You know, Matt, I think it was on the ground, but you essentially had Cash out on the apron, you know, ready to do a springboard, but he's like looking around and you can tell him, like, in his mind, like, he's selling it that he's like, do I do this or do I not? You know, we're not the flips guys.
Yeah.
But then he goes and he goes for a springboard 450 and he misses. And, you know, and then he gets up and gets super kicked and then they pin him. And that's how the Young Bucks win, essentially, because FTR Cash decided to go flips instead of fists. And it's just like to the last drop. This is just storytelling all along, so yeah. It was masterful, I thought.
And he got super kicked with the hurt foot.
Yes, that was the
after
other
the boot. After the boot had been taken off, yeah, like and that part, I guess, could be questionable. Like you're going to be like, all right, well, what is the power level behind a hurt ankle? But at that point in the night, at that point in that match, it's not that big of a deal. Like it is absolutely amazing. Like I said, between the great work, the great storytelling, and the homages to tag teams of the past.
Yeah.
Boom. I'll say it for a third time. Tag team match of the year.
Yeah, I expect we'll see a rematch of some kind between the two of them. I just have no idea how they'll ever overcome it, you know, like how they'll ever top it. So
yeah, and maybe they don't need to. I honestly, maybe they don't need to top it, but as fight forever.
Yeah.
Cool with it. You know, if we will give us a 3-hour pay-per-view where the first half is Omega Page and the other half is Young Bucks FTR.
For sure. All right. Well, next up, we went from kind of your greatest traditional type wrestling match to one of the oddest things I've ever seen, and essentially something that turned into a really dark and brutal fight. I would just call it a straight up brawl. But this was the essentially return match between Matt Hardy and Sammy Guevara. They called this the Elite Deletion match. It was filmed on location in Cameron, North Carolina, where Matt Hardy lives. And it opened up, Kyle, with Sammy driving up to the Hardy compound in a pretty sweet custom Spanish God golf cart.
That was pretty awesome. And I love just the use of the golf cart. Like, it's never going to go away. You know, it's forever cemented into the Matt Hardy, Sammy Guevara, you know, feud is golf carts galore on both sides.
It's true. You know, I don't even know what all to say about this match, but we saw the return of Neo One. We got hologram Matt Hardy. We got monster truck Matt Hardy.
After Sammy Guevara ran over a toy monster truck.
Yeah. Yeah, that was actually pretty amazing. He just crushes this little children's toy in the driveway. And then out of the dark, you just see a literal monster truck with Matt Hardy at the helm come in. And he, like, smushes the golf cart, you know?
Yeah.
And that is pretty much how this fight started. It was just a straight-up brawl in the dark of the woods. I will say I thought that one of the coolest moments was really early on there. You know, Sammy avoids getting squished by the monster truck, fights Matt Hardy back a little bit, and then jumps up on the tire and does a moonsault off the monster truck tire onto the, you know, pretty much the dirt ground.
That was really solid. And eventually, yeah, they made their way over, you know, after battling through the woods and in the pine, they made their way to a ring, which is always the funniest part of these, that there's just a ring, like, ready to go. And it did. It got brutal. We saw a couple cameos as well.
Yep. Yeah, we saw, we had Santana and Ortiz show up. We had Private Party helping out Matt Hardy, but it did not stop there. It went on to see, I was literally losing my mind, but Hurricane Helms and freaking Gangrel.
Gangrel.
Where has Gangrel been? You know, probably still in Hagerstown, but, you know. but Gangrel from the Brood days of Attitude Era WWE shows back up. And I don't know if you caught this, and I probably have missed a couple of moments or matches, but there was this weird moment where somebody questions, like, why Hurricane Helms was there, and Matt Hardy goes, long-form storytelling.
Yeah. It says he had that bracelet on, and he ripped the bracelet. He's like, oh, thank you, Matt. Where have you been? He's like, long-term storytelling. Yeah. And then he was like, I had to get to AEW to finish this.
Yeah. It was so good. Like, just more of those subtle details getting worked in. But, man, yeah, they ended up in the random ring that he just happened to have, like, in his side yard. They pretty much go out. They're fighting along a lake. You know, it had one of those tones of, you know, like the Undertaker-AJ Styles match at WrestleMania, where it was very dark and gritty. But ultimately, you know, they turn the whole thing into a war zone where they pull out. They were like automatic machine gun Roman candles that I've never seen before, but they're just flat out shooting each other. There was one moment where they had this scene where, like, Hardy was literally, like, laid down prone in what looked like a trench. Like, he was, like, in a war zone, you know, just hurling, you know, fireworks, reds and greens just off into the night. So it was wild. And then they ended up in what he called the... What was the building of deletion? The dome of deletion.
Dome of deletion, Oh, before we get there, when they were fighting alongside not just a lake, it's the Lake of Reincarnation.
Oh, yeah.
Which several people got thrown into, and I would love to see any one of them come back as something different. But, like, when they were firing the fireworks at each other, and, like, Proud and Powerful and Private Party were just, like, taking shelter in the ring. And I don't know if it was Santana or Ortiz, but they were, like, laying on top of the other one, like, protecting them. The whole thing was just utter nonsense.
Yeah.
And that was all, like you said, before they even got into the Dome of Deletion.
That's right. Yeah. You can't even explain what we're even seeing with some of these matches. Like... They are fun, and it was entertaining. Like, it keeps you watching, so I don't mind so much of it. You know, it's like the circus aspect of wrestling just coming through to the max, you know, with these these pre-recorded matches. But they've done a pretty good job with all of them, you know. None of them have made me want to turn away, with the exception of this one kind of at the end, because, you know, they make it into the Dome of Deletion. Hardy finally gets Sammy pretty much by himself. And it's just a warehouse with all of, you know, Matt Hardy's, like, most iconic items. There's the chair of wheels and the piano and the lawnmower. You know, there's just all these things that have been kind of iconicized in his different videos and things from the last few years. And then there's another wrestling ring with some tables, a 20-foot ladder. And they pretty much go at it from the get-go. You know, Sammy's choking Matt out. He climbs up on the 20-foot ladder and hits a swanton through the table, which looked pretty gnarly. But I don't know about you, but it was the end of this match that I thought went a little onto the edge of what is acceptable in a wrestling match.
Well, I'd say there was a lot that went over the edge. Like, I felt like when he was choking him with the wrestling ring... Like, that was a little over the edge. I was like, oh, God.
Well, that was one thing and looked weird, but it was really when... So after that happened, and then he drops the swanton onto the table, Matt Hardy recovers and then spears Sammy off the ring through the other table, and when they go to him on the ground, because it's just a concrete floor, there's a pool of blood under his head. Did you not pick up on that?
I did. I did not.
Oh, yeah. There was a pool of blood right underneath his head, and he's laying there. And so after seeing it all, I came to the belief that because this was a pre-recorded match, that was, you know, movie magic, essentially. And it was, and it was corn syrup, you know, or whatever that they use. It was fake blood. But like the first look when you see, you know, the in real time, the boom off the mat, and then, you know, what looked like him hitting his head on the back of this concrete, and knowing what happened in the first match where Matt Hardy took a head blow off of concrete that was pretty ugly.
Okay.
Like, it kind of just looked like, dude, like, he just cracked the back of his skull open. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I'm talking, you know, a 6-inch puddle of blood is what they had underneath his head.
I don't know, it kind of
elevated everything, you know? And you're like, holy shit, is this real? Is it not? You know?
Yeah, I don't know where what I was. I have no idea how I missed all of this, but I somehow have missed all of this.
Yeah, well, it was just before, you know, this was right before the end. So, you know, Matt keeps attacking him. He's hitting him with the chair, which is also, I think, why it made it so graphic, because it's like he looks like Sammy just had this massive head injury, and now Matt Hardy's just repeatedly hitting him with a chair even more. I think ultimately you could tell, though, that it was more, you know, movie magic is how I'll put it. Simply because when Sammy got up, you know, you didn't really see like a giant gash in his head, and like, but the amount of blood that was there, like, you know, you see like the little cuts that wrestlers get, and it just never stops bleeding. Like, he didn't have blood, you know, just covering his head, covering his back, you know, so that kind of gave it away a little bit. But like that first moment, they got me. It was like, oh my God. And then, you know, they finished up the match with the chair shots, and then they went pretty much with the same exact finish if you think about what Orton did to Edge, you know, months ago, where he laid him out in the ring and then, you know, pretty much finished him off with the chair over the top of the back of the head.
Yeah, yeah, and then pinned him. That, yeah, so like the ending.
That's how they wrapped the match.
I do remember, but I don't know how that escaped me. Like, because it's, yeah, I feel like I'm going to have to go back and rewatch it again.
Yeah, just those last couple of minutes. It was kind of the final sequence, essentially. But, you know, it went from kind of zany, fun, kind of craziness, you know, for the first, I'd say, like 85% of it. And then when they got in the Dome of Deletion, you know, it was pretty much a little bit darker turn. And, you know, ultimately, like we said, he hits him with the chair, pretty much knocks him unconscious and gets the pin. But he ends up calling Private Party over, and they dump him into a trash can and put him on a truck, and he just, you know, gets driven off.
Senior Benjamin. Yeah, I saw Senior Benjamin drive him away.
So, you know, who knows what happened to Sammy Guevara? He has pretty much officially been deleted. He might just be dead. I don't know.
Like, he might be dead. Like, I mean, it was something else. Like, the whole thing, top to bottom, like, the commentators didn't know what to say. Mm-mm. The crowd, like, didn't know how to react. Like, everything was so quiet and so awkward, because I'm like, I don't think anybody knew what they were seeing.
Well, I will say, though, it was probably good timing, being that Sammy got deleted the way he did, because the next match that had to somehow try and follow not just a great pay-per-view, but that craziness, was actually Chris Jericho versus MJF for the Inner Circle entry match. So, you know, you kind of come off of the Hardy match going, well, Jericho needs a new person for the Inner Circle because Sammy Guevara is completely eliminated.
You know, yeah, like, he's gone.
So, you know, it brings us over here to something that they've been building for just a couple of weeks now, but I actually thought that they did a decent job. I don't know if you caught the dancing dinner of debonairs or whatever they did with the steak dinner and the show tunes and everything like that, but they did some fun, interesting stuff leading up to this match. I don't know if it ultimately lived up to all of that, but going into it, I thought that MJF versus Chris Jericho on paper was exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a solid story build on paper. You know, Jericho, amazing wrestler, you know, storied past. MJF, solid up-and-comer, finally turned Chris couple pay-per-views ago into an MJF fan. Unfortunately, I felt like this match was in a weird spot, very similar to the Sheeta Rose match earlier, where the previous match was just slow. And yep. maybe not that the, the Elite Deletion match was slow, but it was bizarre enough that, like, you didn't know what you needed.
Yeah.
Or what you had just watched. So you needed a match that could pick things back up.
Right.
And unfortunately, I don't think this match executed that as well as Sheeta Rose, because they had some decent back and forth and they both delivered some solid moves. Neither one is going to give you a fast-paced match at this point in their career.
Yeah, I totally agree here. I actually thought that it was kind of a letdown, you know, pretty much from the moment that MJF came out awkwardly in his Y2J-like intro. You know, it just didn't fit right.
Yeah.
The screen went out. It seemed like Tony and Excalibur and them didn't even know what was going on because the screen was just black for a few minutes. Like, I thought maybe we lost signal. And then kind of, you know, some half-assed Christmas lights show up and it's MJF's robe. I saw what they were trying to do with the old school, because that's how Jericho always would come in for years there, you know, with the darkness and the lights on the jacket. But that didn't work. I thought they had a few botches early on, unfortunately. Like, there was one sequence where MJF was clearly supposed to follow it straight into clotheslining Jericho to the outside of the ring. And he kind of paused in the middle of the ring, and Jericho was just standing there, and then he came in. Like, you could just tell that it was a mistake. And not typically what we see out of both these guys. They're usually pretty clean wrestlers that can, you know, have a decent match with anybody from what we've seen. Like, don't even have to go into Jericho's, you know, abilities. He's been plenty proven. But it was odd. It was slow. It was awkward. Like, it just didn't feel like what we were expecting going into it.
No, and I'm right there with you, and I think that's what frustrated me a little bit is, okay, so they had a few Judas effects, and they both hit code breakers at one point, which was, you know, nice that you got a little, you know, we're going back and forth, and you saw what they were trying to do, and it just wasn't working.
Yeah.
And very similar to the entrance, like, you get it, okay, I see what you've done here. But the execution of it all just isn't up to par with what we expect out of Jericho. And at this point, what we expect out of MJF.
Right. I kind of chalked it up to, like, a lack of synergy, or, like, it almost felt like this was literally the first time the two of them have gotten into a ring together.
Yeah.
Like, maybe they were talking about what they were going to do over Zoom. And, you know, they're both professionals and all of that. But it kind of just made me feel like maybe this is literally the first time these two dudes have ever actually gotten in and started hitting the ropes together. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
it just wasn't quite there. It had a good couple moments. You know, Jericho at damn near 50 still has an amazing lion salt. You know, he hit that Frankensteiner off the top rope on MJF.
Yeah.
Like, highly athletic for a dude that's damn near 50. I don't care who you are, you know? So there were some moments there. The Heat Seeker pile driver out of the ropes, I thought, was a pretty cool looking move. So it was entertaining enough to keep us, you know, pulling through it. But I just kept kind of going, man, it was late in the night, kind of winding down after how much energy had been expended earlier in the pay-per-view. It felt like it was falling flat.
Yeah.
We ultimately saw Wardlow show up to give MJF the Dynamite Diamond Ring so he could use it, and that didn't work out right. There was a funny moment there, right, when Jericho gets the bat from Hager, so they're both kind of using weapons, trying to get the upper hand, and then the ref saw him, and MJF played possum, you know, and, like,
he gave him the double bird, and then acted like he got hit. Yeah, that was pretty good. It was a solid finish. Well, I'll let you go ahead and I'll finish it out there.
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, all that kind of turned into him pretty much surprising Jericho with a roll-up and getting the pin, you know, kind of getting one over on the crafty vet, but it gives him entry into the inner circle. What were your thoughts on the end of the match? And then I wanted to see what you thought about this meant for the inner circle before we headed over to the final match of the night.
I enjoyed it. I like that he outsmarted Jericho with his own move and the bat fake move and give him the old, you know, lie, cheat, steal to get the victory. My only issue with that is Ricochet literally did that like 3 weeks ago on Raw. And like, while I get it, different company, different
sure,
show.
Yeah.
It was one of those things where like, you know, come on. Like, because that highlight of Ricochet doing that was everywhere on social media. Like, I kept seeing it every, he did it to Cedric Alexander.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, you know, I like where your head's at. And the night was peppered in with a lot of homages to older wrestlers and different things here and there. And you can pay homage to Eddie Guerrero and I'm going to love it. But it was like, Ricochet literally just did that.
Too soon.
It's like,
too
soon. But ultimately, like, it's not like it ended in a DQ.
True.
You know, it ended in the roll-up, so it was slightly different. So, but it got him where it needed to go. It got MJF and Wardlow into the inner circle,
which
I think is actually the most intriguing part of that. While all the focus is going to be on MJF, who is a bit of a younger version of Jericho and could become, you know, in time, the new face of the inner circle.
Sure.
I think at one point we thought that might be Sammy Guevara, but it's not now there's a definite clear line of succession. I think the more intriguing thing is Wardlow and Hagar both being in the inner circle and clearly having problems with one another.
Well, you've got them, and then you've also got, you know, Santana and Ortiz have not been happy about the idea of MJF joining the inner circle at all. You know, even Sammy wasn't really digging it. So that's why I was asking what you think it means for the inner circle. You know, I had the follow-up question here. Will it be the beginning of the end? Because, you know, while you have some serious new powerhouses getting added to that faction, you also have some extreme personalities. And, you know, is it going to be a long-term ad? Is it going to turn into just a fracture early? You know, I was just curious if you had any theories.
Oh, well, knowing that Sammy got thrown, you know, got deleted, may he might come back and not need the inner circle anymore and really break away from the bad guy shtick that the inner circle presented and kind of turn good guy, turn face for us, which would be cool and proud and powerful, like on the same lines, like they've played this heel role for a long time. So maybe we could see them turn a little face and totally shake up the dynamics of the inner circle. You got to imagine that if Hagar sticks around and you've got a group that is strictly Jericho, MJF, Wardlow, and Hagar, I want no part of that.
That's true. They would be pretty hard to mess with. Yeah, we will have to see. As we've seen kind of throughout this pay-per-view, there were a number of outcomes that definitely shake things up a little bit, leave some questions, you know, going into Dynamite this week and beyond with Revolution in February. So we'll definitely have to keep our eyes on it. But we are now here at the end. This was one of the bigger pay-per-views that AEW has done, but this was Match 9, the go-home match, the main event, and it was Jon Moxley, current AEW champion, up against Eddie Kingston in an I Quit match. And this is really essentially an anything goes match. So we knew with it being I Quit that we were going to get some hard hitting shit here, that we were going to get some craziness. You know, both these guys are long standing indie wrestlers with a history, and they've both are known as tough guys, you know, pretty good on the mic. I'd say Kingston, it's probably his strength is, you know, being on the mic, cutting promos. So they really got this build going over the last couple of weeks and bringing in some of those personal aspects between them to really fuel this up. And so, you know, for me, it was one of the least exciting matches on the card just because I am not into Eddie Kingston at all. The mic is fine. The family thing is weird. He's so unathletic. Like, the dude cannot wrestle, like, at all, pretty much, in my opinion, you know? like, he couldn't even kick. I don't think he can kick above the knee. You know, looking at what he was doing last night, like he just seems like he's just used up in a way. You know, I know it sounds harsh, but so I really wasn't overly excited about this match. I don't know what your thoughts are there, but it played out exactly as I thought it would.
Yeah, like two death match specialists in a way with the barbed wire and the thumbtacks and the craziness. I can't say for Eddie Kingston's like wrestling ability. He definitely doesn't have the look. For me,
no.
I think his ring gear is god awful, and the green
worst.
Did not help.
Yeah,
I'm not judging anyone on having a belly, but like you know, ring gear should accentuate what you have and not show off what you don't have.
Yeah.
And so I don't think Eddie's ring gear is doing him any favors.
True.
You know, I don't need everyone to be chiseled. I don't need everyone to be a Spanish god. But, like, you know what I mean? And then the other side of this, maybe it's just in my older age, I do not enjoy these matches anymore. And, like, the blood and the tacks and the barbed wire bats. You know, maybe at one point in my life, it was very entertaining. But now, seeing somebody get totally cut open is just not for me.
Yeah.
And it's kind of turned into, like, I want to see Mox do something different.
Right.
Because he's the AEW champion.
Yeah.
And this is not the type of match I want to see night in, night out. Out of my AEW championship.
Yeah, I think that's where I agree with you there. Like, it's okay to do these matches on occasion for me, you know, not as big on them as I used to be. They're also not as common, but it feels like we've been getting them more often. So I'm with you there. Once a year, twice a year, you want to give me something that's kind of pushes the buttons and makes you cringe, then okay. But I think the problem too with these guys is that it wasn't really a wrestling match. This was a slap match. They just chopped and slapped the crap out of each other and then used the props to essentially make it like something was going on in the match. And I know some of that is just what you get out of these matches, but you can have actual wrestling matches where the weapons or the tacks or the things that we saw come out, you know, get worked in. And I think that would be, that's my preferred way to see a death match, right? You know, it's not just about the pain. It's these guys are still putting on all the textbook needs of a great wrestling match. And oh, by the way, they've, you know, worked in these other things. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Oh, 100%. Like, I feel like even the thumbtacks, when Mox got thrown onto the pile of thumbtacks, it wasn't even a well executed hip toss or suplex or whatever right. It was. It was just kind of like he pushed him and he fell over into it. Like, it wasn't clean. And that's what you want. Like, at least still give me clean wrestling.
Yeah, yeah. So to me, there just wasn't a whole lot memorable here. And I think also twofold, just to be fair, you know, as we said with the MJF match, like the pay-per-view did start to lose momentum post Elite Deletion match. You know, it was late in the night. You had back-to-back essentially slow matches here now. And so by the time this, you know, Moxley-Kingston match was like halfway through, I was kind of over it. If I'm just being totally honest, you know, it was just, okay, let's see who wins.
Yeah.
I had no expectations that Eddie Kingston was going to win this match at all. You know, good for him. It was a nice nod and a prop to give him, you know, the ability to be on this stage. But I just like him more as a mouthpiece. You know, if he wants to continue to promote the family and kind of work in maybe like a Paul Heyman type capacity, because he is solid on the mic, you know, that's fine. But I just really wasn't into it. The tacks, like you said, were kind of a miss. You know, he even tried to like throw him into his skull. I thought that was kind of odd, but I don't understand why he sat there just stomping on his balls like for, you know, repeated times. Like, I don't know. It just, none of it did it for me in this
one. Yeah. The barbed wire, like around your fist and delivering the punches, like the alcohol, you know, going to the first aid station and grabbing the alcohol and dumping it on him. Like, sure. I see what you've done, you know, and I see where you're going. And I'm sure somebody out there is like, oh, that had to have burned. But for me, I actually was like, I bet that's water.
Yeah.
Like,
right.
I actually thought that to myself. I was like, I bet that's water and not actually alcohol.
Yeah.
Cause like in that moment, why wouldn't you fake that?
Right.
The tacks were real. So kudos there. Cause they did it. They zoomed in on the tacks and I was like, I was like, damn, those tacks are real. That's not a fake thumbtack. So it just, the whole thing. And like I said, maybe it's my age. Maybe I've just moved past matches like this and I don't have the blood and guts desire anymore, but I thought the ending was disgusting. Like, I thought the whole, like, when Mox put the barbed wire around his arm and then got him in the choke, like, I was like, man, Mox is straight up trying to murder Eddie Kingston. Like, because, like, what else am I supposed to think? You've taken barbed wire and you've put it around somebody's throat.
Yeah.
Like, what else am I supposed to think here? You're trying to slit his throat.
Yeah, and I feel like the other problem really is that the death matches in AEW have progressively gotten worse. you know, like thinking back, like we were talking about Kenny Omega and Mox in the very first one where they, you know, that match was pretty amazing. Like there was so much to talk about in that match. And they also did some things that we don't see as often on American wrestling, on American television, with like that whole web of barbed wire and everything that they did. And then, you know, we also saw some really pretty intense death matches with some more unique type stuff in them between Darby Allin and Jimmy Havoc and those guys when AEW first showed up. And it just seems like since then, they haven't been able to capture the same level. And I don't know if it's just participants or maybe they got their hand slaps or they're doing a little bit more generic stuff, whatever it may be. But all in all, you know, I'm kind of over that part of Mox's stick. He's too good to be pigeonholing himself, even though I know he's really big into those types of matches and that style. But he's got to find a way to make it more interesting because, unfortunately, his last couple matches have been on the lower end of the spectrum as far as rating the card.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And I thought you were going to say it, but then also you kind of took it somewhere else. But I'll say it, too. And to bring it back to the Omega, I'm over Mox as champion.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, he's had his run, and I'm super happy for him that he got the run. You know, he got the belt, well-deserved, and has had it for a while. Super happy about that. But I feel like it's time to pass the belt. And I like where they're going. I like with Omega beating Page. He came out there after the match. They had their stare down. It's exactly 1 year after their big match at Full Gear 2019, which was that other death match. So it's very like coming full circle with those two. But it almost broke my heart when the match ended and all that happened, the pay-per-view ended. I sat there and I reflected and I was like, wow, I am having a legitimate thought that I'm kind of done with seeing Jon Moxley as champion. Like, I'm ready to see it move on to somebody else and to get new types of storylines. I'm not saying I want him to go away.
No.
But I'm ready for him to move somewhere else into the card.
Yeah. It's just been stale and repetitive, you know? You got to keep it a little bit more fresh. So, you know, I thought maybe the last pay-per-view would have been a good time to start. Didn't quite happen. He'll probably hold it through Revolution, you know, so a couple more months. But we'll have to see there. So I fully expect Omega to win at that point. You know, it just seems like it makes sense for all the reasons we both mentioned here. And now we'll just have to kind of play the game and see exactly how they build to that match and what happens. I kind of expect, just because it's Omega, right, I kind of expect that match, Moxley will probably lose it, but it'll probably be the best match he's had in like 6 months, you know?
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. Well, and they made a comment right there at the end that Omega wants a real match. He wants a wrestling match. I don't know if it was Shivani or Excalibur that he actually pointed out and said, like, this time around, Omega doesn't want to do stipulation. Omega wants a one-on-one traditional professional wrestling match. And I think in that situation, given the two characters, Omega is going to come out on top.
Yeah, yeah. I think that would make sense, and I think I would want that more, too, you know, especially because he gave Mox what he wanted originally, so give Omega what he wants this time around, so that's a good call out. But that was the entire card. Like I said, it was stacked, 9 matches. We're going to leave you here real quick, if you hadn't figured out already, with our matches of the night, and then we will get out of here and send you on your way, so I will go ahead and ask you, Kyle, what was your match of the night?
If it wasn't super obvious earlier when I got hyped up like a 9-year-old drinking Mountain Dew and Pixie Sticks, it was the tag team championship match between the Young Bucks and FTR.
Hard to argue.
Like I said, yeah.
If it's match of the year, it's going to be match of the night, right?
Right, yeah. That would just be ridiculous if I was like, it's the tag team match of the year, but it's not the best match on the card. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What were you thinking? What were you saying?
For me, I went back and forth. I mean, it was 1A, 1B here, but ultimately I stuck with Omega and Paige for the Eliminator Tournament final just simply because of that build. And when I was looking at, you know, they both delivered the tag match in this one the way they needed to. But for me, just looking at my excitement coming in, I was a little bit more interested and excited for that match than I was, even the tag match. So I kind of stuck with that one, but kind of splitting hairs, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Either or.
And I think it's important to note that both matches had long-term storytelling.
Yeah, that is true. That is true.
You know, that does matter. While the pay-per-view as a whole had some pacing issues, overall, we are excited to see AEW get back on track with a solid showing. Hopefully, they can take this momentum into the next few months as they build towards Revolution in February.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this chapter, be sure to hit the subscribe button to get new chapters of Geek Catch-Up every 2 weeks on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, CastBox, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Be sure to follow the show on social media. You can find us on Facebook and YouTube at Geek Catch-Up Podcast or on Twitter and Instagram at Geek Catch-Up Pod. Links to all these accounts are in the show notes below and on our website, geekketchuppodcast.com. Stay saucy, you nerds.